Welcome to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And today, a little later in the show, we're going to be talking about the Millions for Prisoners Human Rights March that's coming up later this weekend. And as you can imagine, we are going to spend a good bulk of this show talking about the events that took place in Charlottesville over the weekend. But before we can move on, as all of you are undoubtedly aware, one person was murdered and 19 were injured in a terrorist attack in Charlottesville, Virginia, carried out by a member of a Nazi organization over this weekend. The events took place towards the end of a day of confrontation between a grab bag of fascist-oriented groups and a much larger number of people opposing fascism, white supremacy, and racism. 32-year-old Heather Heyer was killed by James Fields, 20 years old, who drove a car at roughly 40 miles an hour into a large anti-fascist, anti-racist demonstration. 19 others were wounded physically, and of course, hundreds were left with deep traumatic memories after the event. Fields currently is being charged with second-degree murder, 3 counts of malicious wounding, and 1 count of hit and run. The Justice Department has opened a civil rights investigation, but has been roundly criticized for not opening up a domestic terrorism investigation. However, Attorney General Jeff Sessions has implied that they may respond to that critique, and perhaps when federal charges come down, terrorism of some sort will be a part of what the feds do. This, however, follows a long pattern of white supremacist terrorism in America, the most prevalent type of terrorism in the United States, being treated as simply just a tragic crime, rather than being more deeply connected to the long history of white supremacist terror from Native American genocide to mass lynchings of black people. The biggest issues being debated here are who is to quote-unquote blame. The fact that this is even being debated as an issue of two sides is quite frankly totally absurd. But let's just step back here. Several months ago, the city of Charlottesville voted to remove a statue of Robert E. Lee, a statue that clearly honors slavery and racism and that most felt was inappropriate. And it's very important we review these statues for exactly what they are. They went up all over the South during the so-called redemption period following post-Civil War Reconstruction. They were placed all over as a recognition that the former Confederate forces were now back in power. They celebrated the brutal and often very, very violent campaigns to eliminate democratic rights for black people and were designed as a symbol showing the return of white supremacy to power. So they are not places of remembrance, they are places of celebrations of racist pogroms and mass voter disenfranchisement that took place between 1877 and 1896. Following the vote to remove the statue, a number of far-right forces became angry, and the Nazi Richard Spencer has been at the lead since then in organizing numerous rallies targeting Charlottesville for daring to challenge hate symbols, along with this guy, Jason Kessler, from Charlottesville. And again, Spencer, Kessler, and their cohort have come to Charlottesville to hold these rallies. And they went ahead and they set up this Unite the Right rally from the beginning to bring a Nazi KKK-style fighting force to Charlottesville. They came under the guise of free speech, but they really came to try to announce a reinvigorated white supremacist movement to the world. They came not only prepared for violence, but some in their social media posts seemed to be hoping for it. And in fact, the Daily Stormer, which is the main Nazi website in the United States, in its own summary of what people should be prepared for, said that people should come prepared to fight, not because of the other side, but because some on their own side were bound to stir up trouble. So that's the scene here. A city decided to take down a statue against slavery. Nazis, KKK members, and other fascists decided, well, they didn't like that. These people who support openly genocide and slavery then declare they're going to have a massive nationwide call for all people like them who could get there to show up to, quote unquote, defend this statue, which, by the way, isn't even possible since they can't reverse the vote to try to remove it. And Virginia law maybe means it can't be moved anyway. So that lets you know that's really about something else. And so, of course, thousands of people from around the Charlottesville area, Charlottesville itself, the country, came to defend the town against an onslaught of actual Nazis, Klan members, you know, legitimate terrorist organizations if there ever have been one. Now, there's not two sides here. In fact, the whole two sides narrative is designed to make it seem like this whole thing is just some random clash of two extremes on the fringes. It isn't. What we saw in Charlottesville was just the raw edges of the real political struggle in this country. On the one hand, there are those who want to pull this country backwards. They want to eliminate the gains in civil rights, women's rights, labor rights, and so on. They want to roll back the clock on the progressive era and eliminate the regulations that keep us safe, or at least attempt to, and the very idea of progressive taxation. These are literally the mainstream views of the Republican Party. Now, the mainstream Republican Party embraces all sort of white identitarian groups and academics like Charles Murray, who promote racist ideas and racist junk science. However, mainstream Republicans usually draw the line at when you openly start displaying, like, swastikas and other Nazi regalia or open KKK-type stuff. Although, as long as you just wrap all this up in just being about the Confederacy, it's okay. That's okay for Republicans. But either way, this type of atmosphere makes it easy for fascists to kind of nest within this broader movement. And then Trump's open advocacy of racial bias and violence against the left supercharged these movements throughout the campaign and made them feel confident, crucially, feel confident coming out of the online shadows that they had mainly been organizing within. And according to an article in Salon.com, some of these fascists are even claiming that they believe the Trump administration is helping to shield them from serious legal consequences in these big clashes. So for the tens of millions of Americans for whom this type of political movement represents not just some abstract free speech, but a real history of death, genocide, murder, slavery, and so on, this is clearly very concerning. The feeling that not only are fascist forces on the rise, but that the highest bodies in the land appear intent on playing down the threat and semi-embracing many of its members. And it's worth noting on that score how some of the speakers at this fascist rally are office holders in the College Republicans and have appeared around the fringes of all sorts of Republican events. Clearly, they aren't being outcast. So in that context, it makes sense a rallying call like Defend Charlottesville would catch on. A group of people who love genocide and murder are descending on a place. Some people were not afraid to bear witness to that. Let's not make too much of the fact that, yes, there were some fights. And what do you really expect when on one side you have people lobbing all sorts of racist slurs, throwing smoke bombs and pepper spraying and people like that? But the fact of the matter is this. No one would have left Charlottesville seriously injured if this white terrorist hadn't decided to try to kill a large number of demonstrators. It was right at the moment that the rest of the fascists had withdrawn, recognizing how totally outnumbered they were. And in that moment of triumph, this cowardly person decided to mow people down. There aren't two sides to that. There's one side. Literally, none of this would be happening if these fascists actually respected the people of Charlottesville and accepted that the Lee statue was just going to come down eventually. They started it, the fascists. They escalated it all spring and summer, and then one of their own people decided to use this Saturday as an opportunity to carry out the true agenda of these forces, which is to use violence to impose their views. Now, President Trump has come out today, 2 days later, and finally condemned white supremacist hate, something he seems to have trouble doing. And while most Republicans are trying to act like they have nothing to do with these people, Trump is actually, in some ways, more savvy. We should not view his lack of a statement as some sort of mistake. It was on purpose. He recognized, and this was the key to his campaign, that unleashing this hatred and bigotry and bringing it out of the shadows could really goose a Republican presidential campaign and maybe actually win the election. So as much as I'm sure he probably dislikes some of the more uncouth aspects of these various fascist groups, Trump knows that it's their meme wars and online culture that help provide the fuel to the fire that helps keep his base going. Obviously, he doesn't want them out there too prominently, but he also knows that this sort of pure race hatred, this white grievance angle, is key to his political base's worldview and understanding and to their motivation to mobilize. It's also worth noting here as well that Republicans denouncing this, many of them are being totally hypocritical. All of them are totally denying the myriad of links between themselves and these type of groups. I mean, Steve Scalise, who put out a very strong statement against white supremacy, himself spoke to a white supremacist group when he was trying to get elected, and he voted twice against a Martin Luther King Jr. state holiday in Louisiana, most recently in 2004. Now, who is your real constituency when you vote against an MLK holiday in 2004? Again, there is only one side to this issue, so if you're going around making excuses for white supremacists today, you are part of the problem. And those are today's talking points, and you are listening to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Puryear, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around.
By Any Means Necessary.
And as we continue our conversation here, we are very happy to be joined by Ben Norton, who's a journalist with Alternet, but more specifically here for our first segment for the next 10 minutes or so, we are very happy to have with us an activist who was in Charlottesville and was involved in this deadly car crash, this terrorist attack that took place. Thank you so much, sir, for being willing to join us here on By Any Means Necessary today.
Thank you for having me.
So I wanted to start with, why was it important for you to be present in Charlottesville on Saturday?
Well, I am an anti-racist and anti-fascist activist, and Charlottesville is a city I care very much about. I have lots of deep ties there, and so being there to help defend that city and defend that community was incredibly important to me, but it was also just incredibly important to be supporting those movements as much as possible.
Well, and as a Charlottesvillian, I thank you for that. And I want to sort of set the scene in some ways, because I think people have, you know, the news has been so negative on so many different levels, but following it as I was in social media, just prior to this terrorist attack, it did seem as if there was something of a triumphant moment of people who were coming together, a large number of people, anti-fascist, anti-racist. I mean, just explain a little bit the context there, because as much as the negative and the tragic is important, I think it's also important to note as well the positive aspects that came out of this demonstration.
Yeah, the minutes before the attack were, I mean, really just nothing short blissful. There were thousands of people marching in the streets, I mean, cheering and holding banners of, you know, love and support and anti-racism. And we were marching. We left from McGuffey Park, which was set up as kind of a base camp for the activists that day. We left there kind of following a group of the Nazi group. The police actually let the Nazis through and then cut us off. So we had to move around the block. And as we were marching, we were joined by another group, another very, very large marching group coming from Friendship Court, which was an area that had been seeing, it's a predominantly black neighborhood in Charlottesville, and they had been seeing obviously a lot of harassment from these far right groups that whole weekend. And so they were there in solidarity with us, with that that neighborhood. They were marching back after having driven out far right activists, and we met with them, and people were just cheering and fists were raised and clapping, and it was joyous. It was an incredibly powerful moment. For me especially, and for everybody involved, it was, you know, the happiest I felt all weekend, absolutely.
No, I think that's a great point to be made there. And you know, a lot of people, and especially what you just were describing in terms of how the march route, the way the police played it, a lot of people were critical of the police presence. I mean, I wasn't actually there, but at least appeared, as far as I could tell, that they seemed more concerned with, you know, protecting certain white supremacist groups and really just trying to stay out of the way themselves. I mean, it did seem like they played a role, perhaps, as someone who was there. What are you thinking about these critiques that have been leveled against the way the police policed this event?
Oh, I mean, those are all absolutely valid. I think earlier today, the ACLU actually released the fact that the police were given a stand down order for basically the entire weekend. So as clashes were happening at Emancipation Park, which is the park with the Lee statue, the Three Percenters and Oath Keepers were actually largely the ones providing security. Police actually stood behind barriers watching the events unfold. Like, there were multiple scuffles, there were objects being thrown, tear gas was thrown, and the police were not doing anything. They weren't intervening at all. It wasn't until they declared unlawful assembly that they had any sort of influence. On Friday night, there was the torchlight march by, you know, the neo-Nazi groups, which was led by Jason Kessler, and there was absolutely no police intervention at all. There were a handful of UVA students who, I mean, are some of the bravest people coming out of the weekend, stood around the statue of Thomas Jefferson at the Rotunda with a anti-racist banner and were literally beaten with, you know, with tiki torches by these Nazis and white supremacists, and there were no police to be found at all in the area.
And so I appreciate you coming on, and I hate to make you relive this, but I think people are curious about this, the moment of what happened. Maybe just take us through what took place in this attack and where you were and how it played out.
Yeah. So as I said earlier, we were marching down Water Street, I believe, which is sort of adjacent to the downtown mall, which is kind of the central, it was one of the central locations where a lot of the events this weekend were going on. And so after we met with the second group of marchers, we continued down Water Street and eventually stopped at an intersection. And we're kind of milling around. We were sort of waiting to see, you know, what course we were going to take. We were either going to, I think, continue towards Friendship Court or march through the mall. And so after just a couple minutes of kind of, you know, standing around, and obviously the mood was still very, very upbeat, very happy, we decided to turn up towards the mall. And so as the crowd started moving, I was relatively close to the front, and we made it maybe 30 or 40 feet up before the car came. And that was just kind of it. I mean, I was incredibly lucky to escape with just some minor injuries, but I still had to, you know, be helped by medics and be taken to the hospital. But I just, it really did just seem to come out of nowhere. I mean, there was no indication. There wasn't any yelling at the front that seemed aggressive. There, you know, I didn't see anything being thrown. It was just, we were just marching, and then all of a sudden, there was the car.
Well, I think that's crucially important because certainly some forces on the right are, I don't even know how they're standing on, have a leg to stand on in this one so far, but they're trying to claim that somehow the guy was provoked into launching this attack, which just the video itself doesn't seem to bear out. So that's very, very important context there as well. I'm curious, you know, as someone who was there, what is the takeaway? I mean, because I think there's so many emotions and so many people who are looking at this and are very confused now. What would be your message to people about sort of what sort of the some of the main, I mean, obviously, I know it's possible to just summarize this so much so quickly, but some of the main takeaways in terms of how people should frame this, you think?
Yeah, I think the main point that I would make is that for anybody out there that's either listening to this or just knows people who are kind of on the fence about politics or, you know, think that maybe anti-fascist groups are a little bit too extreme. They may not like, you know, might not like the Nazis either. They just want to find this balance. We have seen the destructive potential of these far-right groups to the point where somebody lost their lives and, you know, many people among, you know, myself included were injured in this attack. Just that neutrality is a position that inherently supports injustice, and that for people who are on the fence or unsure, now is the time to get involved with local groups, to, you know, talk to your friends and your family and start contributing to anti-racist and anti-fascist movements in whatever capacity you're able, because this does not go away without action.
Absolutely. Well, and let me ask you this, the last minute here. How important is it that people continue to raise their voices and not be cowed?
Oh, absolutely imperative. I mean, like I said earlier, silence is violence, and it is going to be terrifying. It's going to be frightening, but the future of our country, the future of the marginalized in this country and around the world depends on people standing up and fighting back in the face of that fear.
Well, thank you for not being afraid to stand up and to fight back and for being willing to join us here and give our listeners some of what took place there in Charlottesville. We're going to take a break on that note. We're going to come back with Ben Norton, who was also in Charlottesville on Saturday here on By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Puryear. Stay with us.
By any means necessary.
Welcome back to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Puryear, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And today we are continuing our conversation here about the events that took place in Charlottesville on Saturday and some of the broader context that's arising from them. And we continue to be joined here by Ben Norton, who's a journalist with Alternet. And Ben, you know, I think one of the things that, you know, I talked about in my opening is this sort of whole question of, like, you know, who's to blame? And I kind of feel like the context of this is crucially important because, you know, I'm someone who's been involved in a lot of protests in the movement for Black Lives, for instance, where this issue of cars potentially running people over has been an issue. It hasn't happened, but it's been an issue. And I'm curious sort of the context of that, because everyone's denouncing it now, but when it was sort of in the context of, you know, people taking highways and stuff, it seemed as if a lot of these sort of mainstream Republicans who seem so upset were more than willing to embrace this type of behavior.
There's no question. And first of all, thanks for having me. It's always great to be here, and you have an excellent show. And this is a really important issue that we should be discussing substantively. I mean, this is not an isolated incident. The question you just asked, I mean, really reflects a much larger political culture that guarantees impunity for the most part for these kinds of white supremacist terrorist actions. There are a few cases in which people are slapped on the wrist, and then there's, you know, a case like this or Dylann Roof, where someone is, you know, likely the, you know, the alleged driver, James Alex Fields, is going to face some kind of punishment. But again, it's not likely going to be terrorism charges. There's a guaranteed kind of impunity. They're put in a different level, whereas if it's a Muslim extremist, you know, that carries out an attack like this, it's immediately assumed to be terrorism. But also looking at the levels of political impunity that are guaranteed. I mean, you mentioned, you know, many Republicans who now are speaking out against this attack because of the optics of it. Because you have a member of a literal Nazi group, Vanguard America, that uses Nazi slogans and Nazi symbols. You know, the Republican Party, like you said, they have certain limits. And when you cross the limit into using swastikas, et cetera, that's when they take a step back, even though they're totally fine with the dog whistling, with the subtle racism. Well, the ultimate irony of this is that multiple red states and local lawmakers in those states have either passed elements of or are trying to pass legislation that would effectively legalize running over protesters in the streets. So Tennessee, North Dakota, North Carolina, several other states have considered actual legislation in local levels of lawmakers, like in local houses and such, that would guarantee impunity from civil liability suits for drivers who run over protesters. And I mean, there's also, you know, this extreme bigotry and this extreme anti-protester sentiment. Fascistic sentiment is also reflected even within police systems. Perhaps most infamously, in February, the head of the Santa Fe Police Union shared a meme on Facebook that said, "All lives splatter." And then it had a car running over protesters, like stick people, and they're flying up in the air. And then the meme said, "Nobody cares about your protest. Stay off the road." This is the head of the Santa Fe Police Union. These are the people who are supposedly supposed to protect and serve. And they're posting ridiculous, gratuitous memes on Facebook joking about running over protesters in the street, like we just saw in Charlottesville. This is not an isolated incident. And the kind of culture of impunity and the kind of fascistic rhetoric we see from politicians, not just Donald Trump, but throughout the system and from, you know, police union officials like this person in Santa Fe and other police, you know, other police institutions throughout the country, that all combined guarantees that this kind of fascist, white supremacist terrorism is perpetuated in the future.
No, I think that's a great point. And I think that, you know, we've all referred to it as terrorism. And I think it's one of those things that it's so strange that that can be hard for people to grasp. And I think almost, I'm glad you mentioned Vanguard America, because one of my problems here, it's like, you know, they're clothing themselves in free speech and people are like, oh, this is free speech. But like, I mean, not only are they telling people come prepared to fight, but then also they're promoting the Holocaust, they're promoting slavery, they're promoting genocide. I mean, it really just seems like an unbelievable fig leaf for them to be like, oh, well, we're here, you know, for free speech. I mean, it really seems like they're there to just show like, hey, fascism is back in America.
It's a complete pretense. These people don't care about free speech. They don't care about free speech for working class people who are oppressed by their bosses who have no freedom of speech. They don't care about working class people they don't care about freedom of speech for people of color who are brutalized by police and by other institutions in the society who are imprisoned. What about the free speech of the people suffering from mass incarceration? What about the free speech of you get on the list? They're using free speech as a, like you said, a fig leaf, as a convenient excuse to justify the fascist organizing they are doing. When you are inciting violence, when you are going out and literally chanting Nazi slogans and calling for genocide of Black Americans, of Jews, of Richard Spencer, mm-hmm. who is one of the most effective so-called alt-right leaders, he is trying to rebrand Nazism for the 21st century. He has openly called for ethnic cleansing of people of color from the United States. This is not freedom of speech. This is incitement, not just to violence. This is incitement to genocide. And because in this country we have this ridiculous libertarian view that inevitably serves people in power mm-hmm. of what freedom of speech means, we inevitably coddle to these kinds of white supremacists and fascists. And they're the ones who are protected by the state, not the journalists, the whistleblowers who were, you know, viciously cracked down, not the protesters who are condemning police brutality, the impunity that police have. These are the people who are the actual ones that have their freedom of speech limited. No white supremacist in any way suffers from restrictions on freedom of speech. The president is a white supremacist. Where do we see left-wing voices in the media? Where do we see mm-hmm. – I mean, these people are all silenced. We are all silenced. We are the ones who are suffering. And the idea that they are victims of freedom of speech is simply a ploy. We see people like David Duke, who is a neo-Nazi, an avowed neo-Nazi who is in the KKK, he's now using this tactic. And he's saying, oh, the left wants to violate our freedom of speech. It is completely farcical, incredibly cynical. And the fact that people on the left are falling for it is very troubling. Even the American Civil Liberties Union, the ACLU, which got tens of millions of dollars in donations from, you know, feel-good liberals, they invested some of their resources in defending these white supremacists. Those resources could go toward helping Muslims who have their civil rights trampled on by this government. They could go use that money to help defend so many other people, but instead they're using their finite resources to defend people who are inciting genocide.
Mm-hmm. No, I think it's a great point, and I think it's, you know, it's one of those points that, I mean, you know, the so-called some people call it the yelling fire in a crowded theater standard, which it's actually not. But the Brandenburg standard is incitement to imminent lawless action. The example given is like a riot. And I just felt to myself, well, like the other day, okay, so this is what these people are putting all this rhetoric out here. And then this guy drives a car the same day into it. Like, how is that not imminent lawless action? I mean, I think this idea that hate speech, you know, there are many, for example, communists who, you know, are on the internet who talk about the need for a potential armed struggle at some point in the future in America. I don't know any of those people who have ever gone and, like, set a police station on fire. I mean, there's no real equivalency between the two, and it's like you, but somehow people still want to balance these scales that way. I don't know. The whole thing is absurd to me.
No, it's absolutely absurd. And speaking of restrictions of freedom of speech, if you are applying for citizenship in this country, the U.S. government still asks you if you are a communist and have ever been a member of a communist party. That is an actual restriction on the freedom of expression. You cannot get citizenship if you are a communist. That this is not just a legacy of the Cold War. This is built into the structure of the U.S. government. Jim Crow was a systemic, not just restriction on freedom of expression, restriction on freedom to live. And many people in this country are suffering under restrictions on freedom to live. Police kill them. Poverty kills them. They don't have access to health care. These are all part of the same thing. But instead, we're framing it as a particular isolated problem about speech. And it's not about speech. It's much larger. When we talk about it as an issue of speech, we're buying into this right-wing framework. That's not how it is. And unfortunately, even in many media outlets, we see that they're kind of in a knee-jerk reaction. They're framing things the way that fascists want them to frame it in. And that's not what it is. Like you said, I mean, this is a supposed, you know, this rally, this hate rally, this incitement rally where they're chanting Nazi slogans, literal Nazi slogans, and using Nazi symbols. They're supposedly exercising their free speech. And then when someone runs over protesters that's supposed to be somehow isolated from their freedom of speech. No, I mean, we have protesters who, you know, at J20 are facing decades in prison for protesting the inauguration of a far-right billionaire bigot who's our president. And these people are facing felony charges for incitement to riot. Why aren't these Nazis facing felony charges? They incited violence through their calls for genocide, and then someone, you know, drove a car and injured 19 people and killed a person. Mm-hmm. Where are the felony charges against them? There are so many levels of hypocrisy and double standards that when we frame it in their kind of framework, we're falling for that ploy.
Yeah. You know, one other thing, and I hate to even give this time, but to some degree, I feel like I have to. You know, I mean, one other really perverse thing that seems to be coming out of this to me is that some people are trying to use this as an example of why sort of centrist politics should not be targeted, and how, well, we're not the real enemy. Obviously, there's fascists. They're the real enemy. And the problem with the quote-unquote far left is that all they care about is a circular firing squad and going after the Hillary Clintons of the world, and they can't see the bigger picture. And that's why they couldn't see that Donald Trump was this extraordinary danger. I think I'm actually being charitable in my description of them, but your thoughts on that line of discussion?
Absolutely ridiculous. First of all, they're the ones who put Donald Trump in office. They whatever you think about Bernie Sanders, they sabotaged Bernie Sanders' campaign. It's very clear that he would have easily trounced Donald Trump. And they did this all sacrificing everything for Hillary Clinton, who is the second least popular presidential candidate, and notoriously corrupt. But not even just with this particular election. Their policies have fueled the far right for decades, and they have constantly prevented the left from articulating any kind of alternative. And what they've done is they've allowed the far right to monopolize the alternative discussion. I mean, it's socialism or barbarism, frankly. Mm-hmm. I mean, Rosa Luxemburg famously said that, you know, 102 years ago. And it's still equally true today. And we see this throughout the world. The left is completely silenced, sidelined, marginalized. We're not allowed access to any kinds of institutional power. We're not allowed to govern in any way. So then you have far-right figures who say, well, both parties are lying to you and the establishment is corrupt. So we are going to, you know, impose this alternative. And the center is essentially allowing that by silencing a left-wing alternative. And even worse than that, you know, this center, the alt-center, I like to disparagingly call them, they're actively in some countries allied with the alt-right, with fascist movements. Ukraine is a great example. I mean, how many Democrats visited Ukraine during the Euromaidan protests in which the democratically elected government of Ukraine was overthrown in 2014 in a coup and replaced with an oligarch-controlled right-wing regime, it's pro-NATO, and that is chock full of actual neo-Nazis. The current head of the Rada, the Ukrainian parliament, is a former neo-Nazi who founded a neo-Nazi party. He's still a fascist. I mean, the Ukrainian government frequently honors Nazi collaborators like Stepan Bandera. And it's not just Ukraine. I mean, this is a country where we see bipartisan support from Republicans and Democrats against the supposed Russian threat. I mean, this is also true for Japan, which has an equally far-right government, India, Syria, and Libya, where the U.S. has been supporting the alt-right in those countries for years. Venezuela, right now as we speak, where there are alt-right Venezuelans, fascist Venezuelans, setting black Venezuelans on fire. I mean, burning them alive. So when we hear the centrists say, oh, it's the far left that's responsible for this, with this horseshoe theory talking point, the far left were the ones who were targeted by fascists this weekend. Right. The so-called far left, i.e. the actual left, the ones who actually stand up for left-wing principles against fascism and racism, they were the ones who put their bodies on the line. They are the ones, one of whom was killed, 19 of whom were injured. And that's just in the attack. At least 10 more were injured in the rest of the demonstrations. So they are the ones putting their lives on the line. When I see centrists do the same, maybe we can have that discussion. But they're not doing that. All they're doing is they're continuing to berate the actual people resisting fascism as centrist neoliberals have done for 100 years.
I think that's a great point. And another good point you made there, too, is people who were injured outside of this car attack. You were there. Again, I wasn't there, but, you know, thankfully to this 21st century, you know what I'm saying? So, you know, there are many elements you can see online. I mean, it seemed to me pretty clear that especially the Traditionalist Workers Party, who decided to come late and fight their way in and leave early and fight their way out, that some of these people, it was, like, crucial for their, like, group identity to come and to assault people. In fact, looking at the photos of Emancipation Park, it actually seemed like the anti-fascists were kind of on the outskirts. Not all that much was happening. And then, you know, things start to pick up. But I mean, this whole idea that there was sort of violence on both sides, it just didn't seem to comport with anything I saw that.
No, it's absolutely ridiculous. And when you look at the police response too, I mean, I've been to so many protests and usually the police are very hands-on. They were incredibly hands-off. They were just allowing fascists to violently assault anti-fascists. And also, the fascists at this, you know, Unite the Right rally, they had their own tear gas. Imagine if a revolutionary socialist at a rally had their own tear gas and were tear gassing other people. That is a felony. They would go to prison. But of course, there's this guaranteed impunity for these white supremacists. And, you know, I mentioned, you know, the cultures inside police departments, you know, that guarantees this kind of thing. The impunity we see for police, you know, wearing All Lives Matter and Blue Lives Matter wristbands and killing unarmed black people. I mean, these are perpetuated in these larger institutions. And looking at the incredible violence doled out against these protesters, I mean, I wasn't physically there. There are very few people at this one incident where Chuck Modi captured video of white supremacists brutalizing a black man with sticks. I mean, you know, there weren't that many of us who were there at that particular moment because it happened very quickly. But fortunately, it was caught on camera, and there's also some photos of it that has circulated online. This is a brutal act of assault. And you can see this horrific video of this man lying on the ground being beaten and bloodied by white supremacists. These are, if leftists did this kind of thing, even against fascists who were inciting genocide, they'd be thrown in prison for years. But again, we see, the last report I saw is 4 arrests. The police just stood by and let things happen as they did. And it was very clear from the beginning, you had Nazis walk in with shields. I wonder why they have shields and sticks. I mean, they're preparing to fight. And police just let them do that. So the idea that this is two-sided you know, as Donald Trump, I mean, when it comes to Venezuela, Trump is absolutely incapable of recognizing the violence on both sides. Mm. He blames exclusively the government for the violence. But suddenly, when Nazis are responsible for inciting the violence, suddenly he talks about the violence on both sides. Yeah. And that's his statement, said he condemns the violence on all sides in Charlottesville. This is not both-sided. This is not two-sided. This is one-sided. It was white supremacists and literal Nazis chanting genocidal slogans, carrying shields and sticks, and their own mace, preparing to fight anti-fascists. And we see the result of that. We see a terrorist attack waged against anti-racists.
Mm-hmm. No, great point. And Chuck Modi will be on By Any Means Necessary tomorrow, so continue to listen throughout the week here. 1 minute left, Ben. Trump's comments, deliberate or just idiotic statement?
Well, I mean, it's a political gamble. I mean, I think he's recognized that at some point he had to say something. It's very clear that even despite these statements, he has fueled the rise of these far-right fascist movements and guaranteed some degree of impunity. And they are very well aware of that. You just see, I mean, there are so many people, so many Nazis at this protest with Make America Great Again hats. They know that Trump is on their side. They know Sessions in particular, you know, a KKK sympathizer, is on their side. And yeah, for political, you know, gains, to manage, you know, the media, every once in a while they may have to condemn these people, but everyone knows that behind the scenes they're facilitating them.
No, absolutely. That's Ben Norton. He's a journalist at Alternet. Please check out all his work there. We are going to take a break. We're going to come back with more here on By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier. Stay with us.
By any means necessary.
Welcome back to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perger, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And today we are talking about the Millions for Prisoners Human Rights March, which is taking place here in Washington, D.C., where we are recording from this upcoming Saturday, August 19th, starting at 11 a.m. In Freedom Plaza, which is right downtown. And we are very happy to be joined for this conversation by Deborah Rowe, who is the Executive Director of Returning Citizens United, also a D.C. organizer of the march. Tyler Hopkins, who's a criminal justice advocate, criminal justice reform advocate, and also a local organizer for the march. And Christian Bose-Hayes, who is also an organizer here with the Millions for Prisoners Human Rights March. Thank you all so much for joining us here on By Any Means Necessary.
Glad to be here.
Glad to be here.
You know, Deborah, I'll start with you. I certainly think this is, we talk a lot on this show about mass incarceration issues and people who are organizing and issues around it. Tell us a little bit about, you know, what you all are trying to bring together here on Saturday. Why is this such an important event as it concerns, you know, what I think a lot of people have seen going on for the past few years of people organizing against mass incarceration?
Well, it's very important for the district. Now, the organizers, actually, this is a national effort that's going on all around the country. But as for the District of Columbia, it's very important, especially since we don't have a local prison here. They closed our prison down in the early 90s, Lorton. And so our inmates are scattered all around the country. Working in these industries that are under the auspice of the prisons. So that impacts families. And, you know, there's a saying when a person is incarcerated, the family is incarcerated. Mm-hmm. And that's how it really relates here because our people, even though when they closed down Lorton, they promised that they would be within a 500-mile radius of D.C. and our families, but they're not. They're all around the country. Visitation is a problem. And communication, period. Children can't see their parents. When they do, now they have laws or regulations in the prisons that no contact. You know, a child can't hug her parent, his or her parent. And, you know, so for the district, it's very important. I mean, all around the country, but we have this unique issue of our inmates being shipped all over.
No, absolutely. And I think it's very appropriate for it to be called a human rights march based on what you say there, because I think people can get a good sense of that. Tyler, why was it important for you to be a part of this event and what's going on Saturday?
I'm personally very committed to marijuana justice as an issue, but I see the way laws in the United States are applied in ways that destroy communities. And the marijuana community, if you can call it that, is just one community that's been targeted. But, you know, there's racial components, there's gender components, class components, and all of those structures of society are manipulated in the prison system. And I've seen that with my eyes, and it betrays the idea that we are the land of the free. So someone needs to speak out, and that's what we're trying to do.
And Kristen, is it fair to put this event in the context? And one thing we talk a lot about on this show is, and I said really, since 2008, I think in this country, we've seen a huge upsurge in both prisoners inside of prison and returning citizens on the outside of prison all around the country, really starting to organize and do a lot. Is this event sort of in that continuum of what I think a lot of our listeners have at least seen around this issue?
Absolutely. So I know that we've seen recently, even with the events in Charlottesville, this whole movement with a lot of people wanting to have a rise of hate towards a lot of like racial justice groups. And what we really want to see is that folks are mobilizing around racial justice. And when we are able to speak out against those groups that show up in places like Charlottesville, I think it's really important. And it puts the context of this march in a really important worldview in which, and specifically in the United States, where the march is asking for the abolition of slavery. And you may have thought that the 13th Amendment did that, but it didn't. And so what's really important is that the 13th Amendment basically said that slavery is abolished except for people who have committed a crime. And so that basically creates this cycle back to re-enslave an entire population based on racial bias and motivated conduct that is based on race, largely, and class, and re-enslaving a population of people that have already been pushed down. And you see that people in Charlottesville are happy to continue that message and to continue allowing that to happen and to not only allow it to happen on a structural basis, but then to enforce it with hate and with continued violence against those communities.
Mm-hmm. No, those are absolute great points. And as I've been saying, and as I said at the outset of this show, you know, the importance of recognizing how white supremacy, racism, bigotry manifests itself in institutions, not just individuals. And I think speaking of institutions, Deborah, this is one of those things that I think people, I mean, I really do like the framing, Millions for Prisoners Human Rights March, because I think a lot of people's attitude is, well, you know, they're in prison, right? It shouldn't be Club Med. It shouldn't be this. It shouldn't be that. But this is not an issue of people want cable TV or something like that. I mean, this is when people are locked up, the conditions really are inhumane. And when you come out, too, it's so difficult. Talk a little bit about that as a returning citizen yourself.
Well, when I think about, you know, all of the stories I hear from inside, there are supposed to be policies and procedures and rules and regulations in terms of contact with inmates and the staff. And a lot of our people are being beaten in staff. A lot of our people in prison, a lot of them are being put in solitary confinement for minuscule reasons, you know, little small matters, anything. A young man wrote me, had his family contact me. He had prescribed drugs from the infirmary. And they came in and did a shakedown, and they and he had to pay for them from his through his canteen. He had to pay for the medication, but they put him in the hole because they found this medication and didn't even think to contact the doctor and say, were these prescribed by the infirmary? And he told them that, but they didn't follow up, just threw him in the hole. So there are a lot of just inhumane situations, and the people, and it's like a form of slavery, and like the guards are the the ones that are overseeing it.
Mm-hmm. I think that's very prescient point. And it raises another issue, and I'm glad you brought this up, Tyler, in terms of, you know, some of the factors that are involved in mass incarceration, especially as it sort of deals with the war on drugs, is also sort of the perception of what's going on here, too. I mean, to some degree, a huge portion of prisoners, you know, maybe not political prisoners in the sense of political prisoners, you know, who are there because of their actions against the state, but because we've decided to say, make marijuana a Schedule I drug and make it highly illegal, we put tens of thousands of people in jail who, you know, probably shouldn't be there in the first place. So that's sort of another issue on top of not only the conditions inside, is it sort of like, why are we even putting a lot of these people here in the first place?
Absolutely. You know, speaking about marijuana exclusively, which most of us agree is relatively harmless, it's the number one pursuit of law enforcement in the country with over 700,000 arrests a year. So the inhumane conditions that Ms. Deborah speaks about, that is being applied to a very wide net. You know, it's capturing a lot of people in that system. So if we were going to look at other systems in the government, would we believe or have confidence in a terrorist list that listed half of America on it? Could we rely on that? We can't. So that's why, you know, policies like Ban the Box are so important, you know, to get discrimination of prior convictions out of the employment process, or at least to limit it. And those are important issues that show the way we've structured society is meant, like Kristen said, to keep the prison class in prison and to keep them subjugated to the state violence and state power.
Deborah, you were a leader here in Washington, D.C. of the campaign to establish Ban the Box. Talk about how crucial the issue of employment is for people coming out of prison, because I think people don't recognize that you sort of get trapped in another type of prison on the outside.
Mm-hmm, you do. When you come home, most people that come home, their families have expectations for them. And so they have that sort of, and I can really call it pressure, you know, and then they're coming home with that drive, I'm going to get a job and I'm going to do better. The majority of them really want to do better. And it shows, because a lot of them come home with a lot of certifications. They took this class. They learned how to use the computer. That's the big thing now, because they are learning that, oh, if you've been in there 20 or 25 years, you know, I know ones that came home and didn't know how to ride the subway or, you know, don't know about an Android phone and things like that. So, but it's very important that they're excited when they're coming home. We need these jobs in place. You know, if you could employ them there and pay them 25 cents an hour, why not give them a job right here? Even if, you know, it's minimum wage. They want to work. They want to show that they can do better. And it really is like a punch, like a knockdown when it can't happen, you know. And so people like myself and Yango and the, you know, Charles Thornton's, the Tyrone's, and everybody else around.
Right.
You know,
it's
important that we pull
DC,
each other up. And, we, you know, that's why it's important to have returning citizens. Not saying you Returning Citizens United, my program, because that's the name of my program. But I mean for us returning citizens to be united, to help pull each other up when we come home.
Well, and let me ask you a follow-up about that, which I think is very relevant, and having had the opportunity to work with you in the past and see this, is the ability of more or less anybody to become a productive member of society. Because I think a lot of times, like, the reason why people will say, like I said earlier, oh, well, they're in prison, blah, 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 is because the attitude is just to throw people away. Well, they did X, and so there's nothing we can do. But, you know, I know people, and people who you know, people who I've met, who at one point were stone cold killers and who are now are some of the greatest mentors for young people ever. So talk about the fact that the transformation process that can happen.
The transformation, it begins in prison because, for example, I write a lot of dozens of letters for people getting ready to come up for parole. But I tell them before I write this letter, because I have a good relationship with the parole board, going back to Isaac Fullwood when he was there, and we established it then, I tell them I need to see two things. I need to see your disciplinary report, and I need to see your education report. What did you do while you were there? Did you take classes? Did you go back to school? What was your detail? Did you work? What did you learn? But I need that disciplinary because I tell them, you're not going to mess up my reputation and blindside me when they say, oh, well, they were in the cell doing this. Mm. You know, I just let me know above, you know, before, and then I can address it in a positive way. Yes, right. He did this, but he went to counseling or he, you know, mm-hmm. like that. So the transformation does begin inside the prison. So people need to realize myself, when I was in, I went to UDC and I took law. I took a law class. Mm. And I my job, I was the front desk. My first job over the jail, I was the administrative assistant for the culinary. Then when I was sent down to Lorton, I was the front desk receptionist for Health Services Administration. Mm. And that's how, so when I came home, they offered me a job. They gave me the badge and everything, right. The corrections bag to come back in to the prisons and educate my peers about health disparities mm. and the incarcerated. So the transformation begins, and so I'm not the only one. You know, there mm. are hundreds of us that want to do better, and there are some training opportunities in prison. I work at Department of Employment Services now, and if someone comes in and we're working on their resume and they say, well, I just came from prison. Okay, what did you do there? I was the maintenance. Okay, that's a job. Right. It's going on the resume, you know, mm. so the transformation begins there.
Mm-hmm. Kristen, I believe that there are going to be some solidarity actions as well inside of prisons, I think, or of prisoners, or we don't know that. We don't know that at all, but I've heard that certainly.
I read somewhere that in a few of the prisons, they are going to have some solidarity.
And the sort of lead-in question I was raising here is around that, which I think is relevant, is, you know, how important is it for people who are on the outside to sort of send these messages of solidarity to those who are on the inside? I mean, obviously, and I think Deborah did a good job, people are so isolated from mainstream society. So it seems like this is sort of like an extra opportunity for people who were able to come on Sunday, not to just sort of make their voices heard, but to make their voices heard perhaps for those who can't.
Exactly. And so that's what we're trying to do, is make sure that people are actually represented at the march, but that we're also helping represent folks that can't be there. And that's kind of the idea of this Millions for Prisoners Human Rights March, is that there are so many people that can't actually be there who should be there, and we're asking, like, who should be here that isn't and why, and how can we best represent and help put their voices forward on Saturday? And so I know there are solidarity actions, and there are going to be solidarity actions from groups like IWW, IWOC, and groups like that. So we're trying to bring it forward and have a whole weekend of events and, really make sure that we're representing folks who are actually incarcerated currently.
Mm-hmm. No, fantastic. I know the IWW IWOC has been doing some work here at DC jail as well, getting folks out. And so I think it's going to be good. And before we move on, just again, we are, if you're just tuning in, talking about the Millions for Prisoners Human Rights March, which is going to be taking place here in Washington, DC, where we are recording from. And certainly our listeners on 105.5 FM will be in the area, hopefully August 19th, 11 a.m. at Freedom Plaza, which is right downtown. So that is what we are discussing. We're joined by Deborah Rose, the Executive Director of Returning Citizens United, Tyler Hopkins, who's also a local organizer here with the march, and Christian Bozhays, also working on the march here. You know, Tyler, I think that it's in some ways, it seems to me just about time for this event, I guess. You know, I mean, I think it seems that one of the things that I haven't seen as much of is so much conversation about mass incarceration, but not as much conversation about those who have been incarcerated really taking the lead of this movement. And it seems like that is really what's happening here with this event.
I hope so. But that may be actually a failure of our media and of us listening. Mm. I know that the prisoner rights and human rights in prisons have been advocated for decades. And I think we are representative of a larger social awakening of how powerless, you know, some people find themselves. Mm. And, you know, I come from a religious household, and to, you know, stuff like this really speaks a large contrast in our society when it feels new to us that we are advocating for prisoners. And it's, you know, that's something that Jesus advocated for.
I think that's a good point. Kristen, we have about a minute left. For those who are listening, where should they go if they want to learn more information about the event?
Absolutely. So the website is IAMWEUBUNTU. So it's IAMWEUBUNTU .com. And we'd love to see you out there. We also have a Facebook group where there is constant discussion from folks who are impacted on all walks of life. And so we have our organizers up there. That's just the Millions for Prisoners Human Rights March. It's a Facebook group. It is a closed group because we just want to make sure that no one's trolling us, essentially, and make sure that we're elevating the voices that should be elevated. And so you just, we'll get you in there in like under a minute. if you join the group, we'd love to have you and continue the discussion.
Well, I love that you guys are using the Ubuntu, the Southern African, it's a Bantu word, a sort of humanist philosophy. Fantastic stuff. Thank you all so much. The Millions for Prisoners Human Rights March, Washington, D.C., Saturday, August 19th. If you listen to this show and you like it and you're in D.C., you should certainly be there. If you can get here, please do. It starts at 11 a.m. at Freedom Plaza. That is going to do it for us here today on By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier. See you next time.
By any means necessary.